Hi there. I'm so excited to welcome you to the Arthritis Life podcast, where we share arthritis life stories and tips for thriving with autoimmune arthritis. My name is Cheryl Crow, and I am passionate about helping people navigate real life with arthritis beyond joint pain. I've been living with rheumatoid arthritis for 20 years, and I'm also a mom, occupational therapist, video creator, support group leader, and I created the Room to Thrive self-management program. I am so excited to help you live a more empowered life with arthritis. We're going to cover everything from kitchen life hacks to navigating the healthcare system to coping with friends who just don't get it. Seriously, no topic is going to be off limits on this podcast. My interviewees and I share our honest stories of how chronic illness affects our lives. This includes discussions about mental health, sex, shame, pregnancy, body image, advocacy, self-acceptance, and so much more. You'll hear stories from all ends of the spectrum, from a person who's living in Medicaid remission from psoriatic arthritis to somebody living with severe mobility restrictions and severe pain from rheumatoid arthritis. You'll hear how people manage their conditions in different ways, like medications, mindfulness, movement, social support, work accommodations, and so much more. You'll also hear from rheumatology experts who just get it. We'll dive deep into the science behind chronic pain and what's the latest evidence for lifestyle changes that can help you thrive with arthritis, including exercise, sleep, nutrition, stress reduction, and more. This is your chance to sit down and chat with a friend who's been there. Ready to figure out how to manage your arthritis life? Let's get started. Hey, I am so excited to have not one, but two guests today to help answer some of your burning questions about what people with rheumatoid arthritis and similar conditions need to know about COVID-19 in the year 2024. So I'm really glad to have Dr. Dave and Dr. Campbell, who are from the Virginia Mason Franciscan Health Rheumatology Clinic and researchers at Ben Arroyo Research Institute. Ooh, that's a mouthful. Dr. Dave, can you start just with a quick introduction? What's your medical specialty and what drove you to your work today?
Yeah, thanks so much, Cheryl, for having me on today. So I'm a rheumatologist and an internal medicine specialist. So I take care of adult patients with different autoimmune diseases in our rheumatology clinic at Virginia Mason, and also collaborate with our Ben Arroyo Research Institute. I got into rheumatology really because of a passion for taking care of people with all sorts of strange and not so strange, very common conditions. I think of rheumatology as primary care for people with different autoimmune diseases, like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis and spondyloarthropathy. But we also take care of a lot of very common conditions like gout and tennis elbow and so many different types of osteoarthritis and other types of arthritides. I think people don't realize that there's over 400 different types of arthritis out there and a lot of other conditions that we take care of in rheumatology. And I also think it's such an amazing field that's seen huge advances in medications and different treatment options for patients. It's really just a wonderful thing to help people to get a diagnosis of what they have and help them find a path towards taking care of any sort of pain or inflammation.
That's so wonderful. And I remember they used to say there's over 100 types of arthritis. Now it's like over 400. It's amazing.
Yeah, all these weird, rare genetic things, a lot of things that Dr. Campbell and people at BRI are looking into.
Awesome. Oh yeah. When we say BRI, it's short for Ben Arroyo Research Institute here in Seattle. We're actually all not that far geographically, but I've just been in the habit of doing everything virtually since the pandemic. So we're talking virtually right now, but thank you so much, Dr. Dave. What about Dr. Campbell? What is your research specialty and what made you get into what you're doing today?
Hi, thanks, Cheryl, and thanks for having me on and allowing me to talk about our research as well, which is, I think, really exciting. And I got into the field of immunology, so I'm an immunologist. I have a PhD in molecular and cell biology with a specialty in immunology, and I got into immunology because I think it's such a fascinating and complex system that when it functions correctly, really protects us from such a wide variety of threats. And that was something that was really fascinating to me. And it really it requires the coordinated action of so many different types of cells that have to work in harmony, right? It's like an orchestra and you have to have the the flute's playing at the right time and the tuba's playing at the right time, and they have to all work together to make it sound great and for it to function well. And then obviously there are cases where it's not functioning well, and the immune system touches on so many different parts of human health. There are some really obvious ones, like in the case of individuals with rheumatic diseases, with rheumatoid arthritis and other autoimmune diseases, but it touches on neurological health and, you know, metabolic health of individuals. So it's really a fascinating and great time to be an immunologist, because we've sort of come to those recognitions recently. So my research focus is really on trying to understand the cells that keep the immune system in check, actually, and prevent it from responding when it shouldn't respond. So that's my sort of sub-focus within immunology.
Well, that's perfect. That's relevant to my interests as somebody whose immune cells are turning onto the wrong thing with rheumatoid arthritis. So thank you so much. Yeah, I'm really excited to, you know, chat with you both today, because even though we're 4 years into the pandemic and there's been a lot of guidelines and things coming out, I think it's still, you know, in my Rheum to Thrive support groups, I just observe that a lot of us patients are still confused. What do we do? How immunocompromised are they? So I think, you know, I'm going to preface this a tiny bit with my story that, you know, before the current pandemic, I was diagnosed in 2003, and my doctor explained that, yes, if since you're on methotrexate plus a biologic, you're a little more likely to get, you're a little immunocompromised, you might be more likely than your friends to get, like, because I was 21 at the time, to get the bugs, infections, sinus infections that are going around. But she said, you know, don't let that stop you from preventing or from pursuing your interests, like becoming an occupational therapist, working in healthcare settings, or even in elementary schools where there's like germ pits. You know, she said, just be, you know, take your precautions, wash your hands, and, you know, and over the 17 years before the pandemic, that exactly played out. I would get the little colds and bugs that went around, but I never got hospitalized for an infection. And so when the pandemic happened, it was a little trickier to know how to proceed, because so little was known about it, and especially little known about, like, the long-term, like, how contagious is it and what are the long-term effects of it? So let's just start with the question of at risk. So how at risk, if somebody has rheumatoid arthritis and takes these disease modifying medications, this is really for Dr. Dave, you know, how careful, people are asking me, like, how careful should I be? Should I mask all the time? Should I not? I know you can't give us the crystal ball answer, but what's your thought process on that?
Yeah. So I think, this is a question that we get a lot. And I think the reality is that every individual person, is an individual and very different in terms of, like, their particular, like, modifiable risk factors and how immunosuppressed they are. I think if you look at meta-analyses, basically compilations of the data from many different research studies on different biologic and non-biologic medications used to treat, say, rheumatoid arthritis or other autoimmune diseases, they all show a trend, like a very wide variation in infection risk, but all of them show a trend towards higher infection risk in every immunosuppressive medicine, whether that's methotrexate or etanercept or adalimumab or abatacept. And so I generally always tell all of my patients on immunosuppressive medicines that you're high risk for an infection. Now, that said, you know, I have patients who are ICU nurses, who are elementary school teachers, who never get infections. And then I have, you know, people who are parents of two kids who in elementary school who are constantly getting infections. And so every single person is a little bit different. We do know that combining different medicines, like being on, like you said, Cheryl, both methotrexate and a biologic medicine, means that you're more immunosuppressed than if you were on just one medicine. And so if you do have different medicines tackling your autoimmune disease in different ways, trying to control your immune system in different ways, it definitely suppresses your immune system. There also seems to be, like, the case where people on prednisone, which really suppresses the immune system, are also at a higher risk. And so if they're on higher than 5 or 10 milligrams of prednisone every single day as a patient, I definitely worry about their infection risk. And so that's also something that's really important. And definitely if you're not vaccinated, you're more at risk for those infections than if you are vaccinated. True for COVID, true for shingles as well.
That's super helpful. I think just the spectrum of individual variants is so fascinating to me. Like you said, you're looking at maybe 5 patients that are all the same age, same diagnosis.
Yeah.
Each maybe has 2 kids, and you're like, one of you is going to be fine, and one, you're all in that spectrum of you're going to be more likely to get infections, but one, some of you are going to be more, is that what I'm hearing? Some are going to be more likely than others.
Yeah. And I'll say, like, sometimes we're always, you know, I'm always impressed. Like, I think about, like, this last month, I'll have a patient who's 95, who's like never gotten an infection in 30 years of being on a biologic, which I think is fabulous. And then I'll have someone who just started a medicine, the same medicine, you know, like 5 months ago, and has already had three upper respiratory tract infections. So there's a lot of variability here.
And that, yeah, I say in my support group, like, all roads lead to uncertainty. Like, at some point we kind of have to cope with that, because we have to not empower ourselves with knowledge and then say, we just have to wait and see sometimes.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, I'm curious, Dr. Campbell, from the, not from the clinician standpoint, but from the researcher standpoint, what does the immune system research that you've been doing tell us about the susceptibility to viruses like COVID for people on immunomodulating meds?
Yeah, well, first I'll echo what Dr. Dave just said, you know, about patient-to-patient variability. We see that when we study people's immune systems all the time, that no two people have an immune system that looks alike. And there's a broad spectrum when we look at people's immune cells in the blood or immune function and measure it in different ways. We see a broad spectrum of immune function within individuals. So it's not surprisingly that those sort of different baselines interact differently with these medications and cause variations in risk that you see, right? So from a human immunological researcher, that's not surprising to me at all. And that fits exactly with the type of data that we got. What I would say about the, you know, what we know about how the various, you know, DMARDs and medications interact with, and what we're really trying to do, all these great DMARDs that have been so helpful in treating RA and other autoimmune diseases have really come out of basic immunological research, right? We're trying to understand how the immune system works. And I mentioned sort of the analogy to the orchestra the other day. And with these DMARD, or the other day, the other minute.
It's been a long day.
It is, right? Feels like a day. With these different DMARDs, what we're trying to do is you know, put the brakes on parts of the immune system that we know are causing pathology in individuals, right? Now, those are, of course, required parts of responding sometimes to an infection or to a particular type of pathogen. And so it's, again, not surprising that, you know, interacting with then someone's, you know, immune variability or the immune variability of the population, that you're going to, by putting the brakes on that, you're going to end up being much more susceptible to particular diseases, right, in some individuals. The example that really comes to mind, you hear a lot in the, you know, talking about over the last few years about antibodies and cross-reactive antibodies to different SARS-CoV-2 variants, right? And individuals who are on B-cell depleting therapies like rituximab, of course, have almost no antibodies, right? Mm-hmm. Or have almost no B-cells to make the antibodies. Those are the cells that make the antibodies. So they're really deficient in that part of the immune system. However, there are lots of redundancies built into this system. And so your antibody dependent immunity might be a little bit weaker, but your immunity that is conferred by T cells might be a little bit stronger then, right? Mm-hmm. So it kind of balances back out and leads to some increase in susceptibility, but not, you know, to potentially the dangerous level.
Yeah, I think that is something that people have asked about, is like, you know, the antibodies after you've had a COVID infection, like how mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I didn't prepare you for this question, but I'm just curious, that's either right. One of you, you know, I've heard people say that I'm confused on this. I'll be honest. You can go get your antibodies tested. And I participated on that COVID research registry where you got it tested, but then other doctors have said, well, those aren't really that accurate. Are they accurate? Or
I think we have accurate measures of COVID antibodies. And one thing I will say, you know, this does cause more confusion, right? But from an antibody standpoint, if you have antibodies and go on a B-cell depleting therapies, the antibodies that you have generally are fairly stable. It's really a generation of new antibodies that is impaired in that case. The B-cell depleting therapies actually don't deplete the existing antibodies. But if you go in and got another vaccine while on a B-cell depleting therapy, your antibody response to that would be very diminished. So if you have the pre-existing antibodies, you're usually pretty good even on a B-cell depleting therapy.
Oh, Thank you. That's helpful to know. And then back to Dr. Dave for the just again, real practical on the ground, day-to-day life. Like I'm thinking about myself. I have a 10-year-old. We just did his birthday party at an indoor trampoline park, which I practically had to medicate myself for anxiety, knowing the risk of, spinal cord injuries and such. But anyway, back to the infection risk, a lot of people have been asking me, what I did a video myself, going to a roller skating rink with a mask on. Because to me, it's kind of like I'm a very cautious in general person, right? Like I'm the graduate of the DARE program, like DARE to keep kids off drugs. And I was like, I'll never do drugs. I'm like, that's it. Check it off. I'm like the person who is very risk averse, but other people are like, anyway, long story short, what are you in general? I know you're not giving anyone individual medical advice, but are you recommending these basic precautions like mask wearing and hand washing, or how do you help your patients work through that?
Yeah, so I think there's a wide variability also in how hesitant people are to re-enter life and engage. I think I have some thoughts on this. One is like if you've already had COVID once and you've been able to get through it, I think there's a high chance that you'll get through another infection. And I often tell people to like have the phone number for the nurses, the on-call rheumatologist, be able to call in for, say, a prescription for Paxlovid if you do happen to test positive for COVID a second or third time. And I think that's important. I think a lot of my patients who've had COVID once are like, okay, I can breathe. I don't want to get it again. Maybe it was horrible, but I'll make it through. I think it can be a lot more nerve-wracking for people who haven't had COVID yet, 3+ years into the pandemic. And I think I tell people, there's no way to know exactly how you're going to do per se. We want to make sure that, if you do get COVID, it's hopefully you'll be wearing a mask. Therefore, you'll have less COVID that you've been exposed to. Hopefully, then you have a less intense reaction. So I think for those patients, it's a little bit of handholding figuratively and making sure that they feel comfortable getting back into society. I'm often telling them to, start with eating outdoors, get out there, meet other people. If you're on a plane, still wear your mask. And I think that's still good, even if you have had COVID once. I know we're going to talk a bit about long COVID and risks of developing that. But I still think if you're in a crowded place, if you're going to your busy Costco, if you're in a flight, I still think it's reasonable to wear a mask. Now, whether it needs to be an N95 or rather just a simple mask, I think the data shows that an N95 is better, but it's also more uncomfortable. And if you're reducing the amount of respiratory particulate you're breathing in with just a regular mask, I think that's reasonable too. And so I think different rheumatologists are giving different advice at this point in time. There's not standard advice on how to get back into society, but I'm still recommending that people hand wash, try to stay away from people with active symptoms of coughing and et cetera. I'd also say, kind of like going back to your other question though, like I'm definitely always worried about my people on, the data that's being collected by the COVID-19 Global Rheumatology Alliance really shows that patients on B-cell depleting therapies like rituximab and abatacept in particular, abatacept not necessarily depleting your B-cells, but affecting co-stimulatory proteins and therefore B-cell activity. Those patients are probably at higher risk of bad outcomes from COVID and seem to have, less response to COVID vaccines. We're not really per se, and I think the data will come out more over time, but we're not necessarily seeing people on methotrexate or TNF inhibitors having horrible outcomes like we initially were really fearful of. And so I'm really trying to use some of that data to calm people, especially people who are more anxious. And here in the Seattle area, I think we had the highest rates of masking in the country. And so definitely a lot more anxiety and stress. And so, I think that should hopefully provide some reassurance to most people with autoimmune disease.
Yeah, that's super, super helpful. And I often think about, for me, when I get anxious or overwhelmed, to think about what can I con my zone of control, like what can I control, the things right in front of me. I can't control other people's actions. I've tried. And then there's the zone of partial control, right? And so, and I think there's the biopsychosocial approach too, where you say, it's important for me to be alive so I can live life. Like occupational therapy is supposed to be living life to the fullest. That's our tagline. So you're like, you can't really live life to the fullest if you're not alive. So, but you need to protect your livelihood and protect yourself from severe disease, but also say, you know, my psychosocial experience is important. You know, I went to the Taylor Swift concert. I was one of the only people masking there. That was a full of a lot of not masking people. But you know, it was like a lifetime, you know, bucket list thing for me. And so we have to make, just like we do with other health behaviors, smoking, driving, an ATV, you know, so that kind of thing, people make the decisions based on, yeah, their own matrix of what importance. But it's helpful that you said, look, there's a line in the sand a little bit, where if you're on rituximab or abatacept, you kind of need to be a little bit more cautious. Dr. Campbell, I don't know if this is the right time to ask this, but do you have any other things that you want to share about how research has influenced like the clinical care for people with RA?
First, I just want to comment that focusing on the zone of control is great advice for everybody. So I really appreciate that. And it's actually advice that I use as well. You have to focus on the things you can control in life.
I'm a recovering control freak. So that's why I have to repeat to myself too.
I think that's just fantastic general life advice, period. So thank you for that. In terms of what we know about the research informing, you know, clinical care and the way that individuals with RA who are on different immunosuppressive therapy should think about COVID risk, I think exactly as Dr. Dave said, our research, and this is research that, you know, we performed in my group and here at BRI, really did show abatacept and rituximab, in terms of at least the vaccine responses, are associated with the lowest vaccine responses, right? So if you're on one of those therapies, even if you've been vaccinated, you know, that vaccination probably didn't protect you as much as it might have protected either somebody who's not on any therapy or who's on like a TNF blocker. So that certainly is a way in which you can inform your risk a little bit more by thinking about those issues. There are some other things, you know, the idea of at least discussing with your rheumatologist pausing medication during vaccination, or you know, certainly making sure that you prioritize getting your vaccination, I think is extremely important when you are in one of these risk categories. So
that's super helpful. And I will link to the ACR, American College of Rheumatology guidelines for the timing of stopping medication, because that has been a helpful guide. I followed that for both all of my COVID vaccines and both my shingles vaccines, which I didn't, you know, I've had rheumatoid arthritis now for 21 years. And I'm like, I'm a young person with rheumatoid arthritis. And then my doctor was like, well, you actually, you know, you're now 42. So you start being eligible for some of these older people things. Like I thought shingles was only anyway, and also for, cause I'm on immunosuppressants, I needed shingles vaccine. But you know, another question for you, Dr. Campbell, is about, you know, the relationship between COVID-19, you know, infection and the risk of the development of autoimmune disease. So what I thought was the case is that any virus can trigger your immune system to go out of whack. But what do we know about COVID-19 specifically? And am I right to think that a virus can trigger autoimmunity in general?
Well, you're absolutely, you know, at this point, there are certain autoimmune diseases that have been more definitively linked with particular infectious triggers, right? And just in the last couple of years, for example, development of multiple sclerosis has been much more tightly linked with a particular type of response to Epstein-Barr virus. So there are examples of this. You know, a virus is an immune perturbation, right? A virus comes along, tells your immune system it needs to do something. Your immune system starts doing things. And anytime you perturb a system, it doesn't always, you know, return to where it was at baseline. So in terms of specifically COVID-19 and RA, though, there really are no clear data at this point that support a link between COVID infection and development, not only of RA, but of any autoimmune disease. You know, these are early days. There's a lot of anecdote out there, right? Individual will have gotten COVID and a month later, you know, be diagnosed with RA or develop type 1 diabetes or another type of autoimmune disease. And, you know, there's a temporal link. So at least in that individual's, you know, thinks that there's probably a causal link between those. And there could be, right? But we just don't have the data at this point in the pandemic to really support a strong link between COVID-19 and development of any given autoimmune disease yet. I think time will tell as we
yes.
you know, have more data on this. You know, almost everybody's had COVID now.
Yeah. Just
remarkable to think about, right?
Except for my own husband. It's just, he's invincible, apparently. I've had it twice. My son's had it once. And just like, he's like, well, I guess I just am.
I'm back at work for the first day today after being out from my first round with COVID. So I had not had it until 2 weeks ago.
Yep. Oh, wow. Well, you get a little badge for making it that long. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, no, that's super, super helpful. And you make a great point about like the correlation versus causation. And I have to introduce this topic in my, one of my educational groups. And it's a really hard one to wrap your mind around, even when it comes to symptom tracking. Like, oh, let's say I want to correlate whether exercise is helping reduce my pain or fatigue. Like obviously over time you can establish like a causal relationship, but at first you're like, you have to not over assume that whatever you're feeling, you could have just gotten a random flare that day that you happened to exercise. Like, and so you're saying that people, since a lot of people are getting COVID and a lot of people in general with or without COVID, we're just developing RA over time, whether from here, what would you add to that, Dr. Dave?
Yeah, no, I agree with Dr. Campbell. I would say that, you know, we need to just follow this out longer and just see larger patient populations. Because there was like a study out in The Lancet in September 2023 that suggested from a Chinese group that maybe there might have been some increased risk of autoimmunity in people who were who developed COVID. But then it's unclear, the vaccination rates are a little bit unclear there. And then it's unclear what was done to attest that those patients actually had COVID, not another virus, et cetera. So again, I think we'll need to watch over time. I think what we are seeing though is that people who have had COVID do seem to be at a higher risk of developing cardiovascular disease and potentially also diabetes. And so if they're not developing you know, necessarily an autoimmune disease, they might be at higher risk for some of these chronic medical conditions that we really worry about. So also another reason why we want to encourage vaccination and encourage prompt treatment of COVID infections, particularly if they seem severe.
That's super helpful. And you know, we're going to talk about a little bit more about vaccines in a minute. But if you have ever felt completely lost or utterly alone while trying to navigate real life with rheumatic disease, listen up. I am here for you. I created an educational program to help you go from overwhelmed to confident, supported, and connected in a matter of weeks. And it's called Room to Thrive. After earning a master's in occupational therapy and completing hundreds of hours of additional training, I created a step-by-step guide to help you truly thrive with rheumatic disease. This is the only program I know of that's designed to improve quality of life for people living with inflammatory, autoimmune forms of arthritis, like rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis, Sjogren's disease, and more. During the self-paced lessons, you'll learn how to manage pain and fatigue, cope with stress, navigate relationships, and continue doing the things that matter to you and bring you joy. The goal is really to help you improve your quality of life and learn how to thrive with your rheumatic disease right now, rather than waiting for a distant day when it might be cured or healed. I really created the down-to-earth, practical, heartfelt resource I wish I had had when I was first diagnosed at age 20. If you want even more in-depth support, you can join the 12-week Room to Thrive virtual support group, where you'll be surrounded by people who actually get what you're going through, people who will provide the encouragement, validation, and support that you deserve. Each group is expertly moderated, so you don't have to worry about the kind of misinformation that spreads like wildfire in the free-for-all social media groups. If you're on the fence, don't just take my word for it. Here's what Katie had to say in March 2023. I was lost and overwhelmed with my RA diagnosis. It felt overwhelming to know what to read, what to do, how to spend my energy trying to research on the internet. Room to Thrive did that for me. It's been like getting a crash course in my diagnosis along with a community who gets it. To see all the details, including the dates for the next support groups, go to the link in the show notes or bit.ly/thriveroom with a capital T and capital R. You can also just email me anytime at info@myarthritislife.net. And don't delay if you're interested, because each group is capped at 16 people or less in order to make a small, intimate group atmosphere. Thanks so much for your time, and I can't wait to get started with the next groups. And I can't wait for those of you who are interested in the self-paced option to go ahead and join that at any time. Bye-bye for now. But I also, since both of you alluded to like, you know, long COVID or symptoms, certainly there's people who have gotten COVID and then had a lot of symptoms that some of which overlap with an autoimmune disease like rheumatoid arthritis. You know, how do you first of all, you know, what is long COVID and how do you distinguish the kind of fatigue from long COVID from maybe the pre-existing, if someone has inflammatory arthritis like RA and they're starting to, they've got COVID and then they're feeling a lot more fatigued than usual. Is it long COVID or is it their own? How do they know if it's their, what's happening? Help, help. No, Dr. Daiva, you go first. What are your thoughts?
So the CDC has a kind of a definition of long COVID and it's evolving, but essentially they focus on physical and mental symptoms that develop usually during or right after a COVID infection, and then are persisting for over 2 months and impacting a patient's life. And it's not explained by an alternative diagnosis, like a pre-existing condition that a person had before getting COVID. And really they bucket these symptoms in three different areas. One is ongoing respiratory symptoms. So symptoms that started because of the COVID infection, like chest pain, shortness of breath, that feeling of dyspnea or a cough. Or two, persistent fatigue with or without like body aches and discomfort, or three, cognitive problems. And I think it's important to recognize that, you know, there's a lot of other symptoms can occur during COVID, like the classic loss of taste or loss of smell that people were panicked about. That doesn't seem to be as big of an issue for most people with long COVID. It really seems these cognitive issues, respiratory symptoms, and fatigue are the bigger things that people are worried about. And I think those are different than how most people with, say, lupus or rheumatoid arthritis typically feel on a day-to-day basis. These are symptoms that feel like almost you're still struggling with the virus and it's persisting, as opposed to necessarily joint pain or flares or swelling.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, and I think something, a little bit of a side note, but I've delved a lot into in the last 6 months has been the relationship between physical activity, strength training, and fatigue, both experimenting on my own body and looking at the literature. And it's been really, like, I don't know if people saw the EULAR recommendations. The first time they put together clinical recommendations for patients with inflammatory arthritis for fatigue. And like the strongest recommendation was physical activity and exercise. And so I have noticed that really strongly in my own body that when I, not just cardio, that was my theory, was that the cardiovascular would be the bigger one because I'm thinking my blood's flowing to my brain, but the strength training has even had a more pronounced effect on my cognitive issues. Still have some, but yeah, I remember when I had COVID the first time I remember, sorry, this is a little anecdote. So if someone else listening doesn't feel as alone or weird, I literally was like trying to feel better. And so I went immediately on Paxlovid, you know, got it taken care of. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna check my email. And I remember sitting at this exact desk here and being like, I opened my email and I was like, what do I do? Like, how do I check my email? Like, it was so weird. Like, I didn't understand what to do. And I was like, wait, I'm not actually ready to email. Like, but that went away. That was transient. Like, that was gone in a week or so. So I also like put my car keys in the fridge, like kind of weird cognitive dysfunction. But so, you know, it wasn't long COVID because it didn't last for a long time. And so I would say the thing I was going to get to with fatigue is that I sometimes tell patients who are concerned that they might also have chronic fatigue syndrome along with their RA is like, if your fatigue gets better with exercise, that's like a symptom or a signal that that's the fatigue is probably from your inflammatory arthritis. Does that make sense? But if your fatigue is persisting after exercise, then maybe it's something else. I don't know. Do you agree with that? Tell me if I'm wrong. I'm always open to be wrong.
I think that's a reasonable thing. Yeah. I mean, I think if the fatigue is really new and it's a very different sensation than what you were experiencing before your COVID infection, then I'd worry that it's related to the COVID. Mm-hmm. And to say that your experience, Cheryl, is actually very common. I mean, one study in Italy of like 2,600 patients suggested that 42% of unvaccinated patients had post-COVID symptoms. So this is 3 months after their COVID infection.
Oh, wow.
And that number actually goes down when you have vaccination. So if you had at least one vaccine, it was down to 30% of patients. If you've had two vaccines, it's down to just 17%. So less than 1 in 5 risk of having these post-COVID symptoms.
Oh, wow.
But also, you know, anecdotally, and we'll have to see over time, there's a suggestion that getting COVID vaccines after you have a COVID infection might help with some of the post-COVID symptoms. And then there's also concern that you might flare up the symptoms if it's too close, like if it's the first 2 to 3 months after having an infection. So time will tell, on how we decide to treat these post-COVID symptoms, but definitely being vaccinated before your infection seems to be protective.
That makes me feel better. I'm vaxxed to the max. And Dr. Campbell, I know you're doing some really interesting, or your research area includes long COVID. What are some of the, what do we know about long COVID from your standpoint?
Yeah, well, as Dr. Dave just pointed out, long COVID's been a little bit difficult to pin down from a, definition standpoint, and that definition has changed, but I think we are honing in on a definition for long COVID that makes it easier to study. It's hard to study something you can't define, or that's difficult to define. But now we're getting to better clinical definitions of long COVID, and with that have come some really interesting insights into that. There's a study that was in part including BRI researchers here called the IMPACT study recently, that published their results last year. And they found some correlations between what's happening acutely during acute COVID infection and development of long COVID symptoms. And really consistent with what Dr. Dave was just talking about, one of the factors that is associated with long COVID symptoms is a higher viral burden during acute infection, which really speaks to the importance of vaccination. Again, when you're vaccinated, you're going to decrease that viral burden. You could still get infected, but you're not going to get infected to the degree that you would if you were unprotected, right? So getting vaccinated is really important for preventing long COVID. We know that that the immune response in long COVID seems to be somewhat, the immune response to the virus seems to be somewhat disjointed. That you that the orchestra is not all playing in harmony together, right? That you have some parts of it that are going off and maybe going in the wrong direction. And that causes some persistent inflammatory symptoms, right? That can translate into the feeling that people get in long COVID. And it's right down to there's a really fascinating study published in the middle of last year that getting to the cognitive and brain fog that's associated with long COVID, that there is a long-term depletion of serotonin in individuals with long COVID. So this is a really fascinating study. It was published in the journal Cell last year that really touches again on how immunity and the immune system interacts with all the other systems in our body, right? And can regulate things as basic as serotonin levels and cognitive function. So
Wow. That's really, really fascinating. And I immediately was thinking also about and I don't know a ton about this, but the relationship between gut issues and rheumatoid arthritis, and a lot of your serotonin is processed in your gut. And there's all these different. I mean, I'm so glad you're studying the immune system, because I don't think I'd have the patience to study it as a researcher, because it's so complex.
Yeah, we tried to take oh, what's the word that I'm trying to come up with here? I just had COVID, as I mentioned, so maybe my
We're
serotonin
finding
levels are low and my
we're
cognitive function might still be a little bit low.
finding yeah no I mean
A
you're doing better than I was after 2 weeks
a
already.
systematic approach to things, right? Where we can study, parts of it in isolation and really try to figure out what they're how they function individually before we can put the whole thing together. But putting the whole thing together has been a fascinating problem.
I'm reminded of that, I think, a lot in memes nowadays, because I'm on social media so much, and there's this meme that's from The Notebook, the movie The Notebook, where Rachel McAdams is like, "It's not that simple." And he's like, "What do you want?" She's like, "It's not that simple." It's like the immune system, it's not that simple.
It is
And so
not. Like, if it's a puzzle, I think we know a lot about the individual pieces, but not always about how they all fit together, right?
yeah, and that's when I do a lot of education on countering misinformation that runs rampant online. So yeah, if anyone tells you that they've got this simple solution to boost your immune system, it's one small supplement. Nope. Dr. Campbell is shaking his head no for those listening on the audio. And so we kind of talked about vaccines a little bit, but just want to, so you already mentioned that, if I let me summarize that, if you're on immunosuppressants for rheumatoid arthritis, are you by nature going to have a worse response to vaccination, or does it, Dr. Campbell, or does it depend on which medicine you're on?
It really does depend on which medicine. I think we touched on that a bit earlier, that some are a little bit more, inhibiting the parts of the immune system that are really responsible for these anti-vaccine responses. And so the two that Dr. Dave brought up that are consistent with our research are abatacept and rituximab as
Is
giving.
abatacept Orencia? Okay,
Yes.
sorry. Wow, that was what I was on at the beginning of the pandemic, actually. Oh, interesting. And then I switched to Actemra, but I didn't get COVID until 2 years into it. But anyway, so I guess I'm look marking myself lucky.
Yeah, we think of the vaccine, the thing that we're doing is we're training our immune system, right? And we're training it through generation of primarily antibodies that will recognize the virus and neutralize the virus and not allow that to enter our cells. And in both of those medications, we're really targeting parts of the immune system important for that antibody generation. And of course, the antibodies are pathogenic in individuals with rheumatoid arthritis. So
What does that mean to people who know?
what that means, people with rheumatoid arthritis have what we call autoantibodies. So they have antibodies that instead of recognizing a virus like COVID, SARS-CoV-2, or the influenza virus, they have antibodies that recognize their own proteins,
And
right?
those are the ones in the synovial lining, right, of your joints.
Yes. Yes.
They
And
get
so
way in there.
they can bind to those proteins and cause an inflammatory reaction and cause dysfunction of the tissue there because of that induced inflammatory response. So you want to target those antibodies in RA, but of course that leaves you more susceptible to viral infections where you'd want to mount a good antibody response.
Yeah, Dr. Darby, would you add anything to that?
No, I think that's all right. The other thing I would just add is that we just don't have enough data on combinations of medicines. And I'll say that a lot, we don't know what happens when you add methotrexate with etanercept to your COVID response. I think time will tell. I think the other area that's going to be really interesting is so tocilizumab, which you had mentioned, Cheryl, Actemra, the brand name. So tocilizumab, is FDA approved for treating COVID lung disease, but does that mean that it prevents COVID? Do we know enough about it? I don't know yet. I think time will tell. At least I'll say that we don't have enough in data on it, but time will tell. I'm very curious about these things, and what does that mean for sarilumab, another IL-6 inhibitor? So time will tell kind of what these medications do and don't do, and who's more at risk. We do know, some things like hydroxychloroquine does not seem to either protect you against COVID or as a former
Why
president.
would you think that? No, just kidding.
Yeah, and nor does it seem to really increase your risk to COVID. So I think we're learning over time. There was a lot of research spent on that for nefarious purposes, in my opinion. But time will tell about other medicines.
Well, you have an informed opinion, so your opinion means a lot. And then did we already, I'm sorry, this is me trying to multitask and maybe not successfully. Did we already talk about hybrid immunity, that previous infection? We did talk about that, right?
We've not talked
Oh,
about
okay. Please, okay.
immunity yet. No. We've not talked
What did we not
about
say?
hybrid immunity yet. My laboratory here at BRI was involved in a study on hybrid immunity. This was relatively early in the pandemic where we looked at the difference in the immune response in individuals who were vaccinated versus individuals who had been previously infected and then were vaccinated, right? And what we could see was that the previous infection plus vaccination gave a stronger response in a lot of ways. So we had, and especially on the T cell side, we actually had a much stronger T cell response, which is not those antibody generating cells. They protect you in a different way by directly targeting virally infected cells. And you seem to have a stronger T cell mediated immunity to the virus in individuals who had hybrid immunity.
Okay, that's super helpful to know. I'm feeling even better about my decision to vaccinate. No, it was not a hard decision.
And in individuals, for example, who are on rituximab, who maybe don't have an antibody response, or have been on rituximab for a long time and have been vaccinated but don't have a strong antibody response, it really is that T cell response that is protective,
I see.
right? And taking over then in that case. And it might not be as good as having everything together, but it is strong enough to provide a lot of protection from infection and still well worth being vaccinated in that situation.
And then I know some people are still worried that maybe vaccinating themselves could lead to them developing an autoimmune disease. What do you say to that?
There's no data. We've studied this at BRI as well, and there's really no data at all to suggest that that the vaccine itself is triggering autoimmunity. We talked about autoantibodies a minute ago, how you have antibodies against your self proteins. We looked for development of new autoantibodies post-vaccination in individuals with RA and other autoimmune diseases, and we saw no evidence that that led to development of new autoantibodies or worsening of autoantibodies that they have. There's no strong epidemiologic data that links vaccination to development of autoimmunity. So I think there I will be much more definitive in stating there's no link, and highly recommend, as Dr. Dave did, going out and getting vaccinated for SARS-CoV-2 if you haven't already.
Thank you. Is there anything else you'd want to add on this topic, Dr. Dave?
No, I totally agree. And I'll just say anecdotally, I've seen no patients who get vaccinated suddenly develop a new autoimmune or anything like that. So I probably have over 95% vaccination rates in my clinic. And so I feel very comfortable with vaccination. Yeah.
That's super helpful. And the other thing we were going to talk about is, the latest research that's going on at BRI about COVID, and there's that you have, Dr. Campbell, the HIPCRV study, trying to understand the immune system better. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, we call it the HIPCRV study. So HIPCRV. It's human immunophenotyping consortium. An RV is for respiratory virus. So this is a study that is really specifically designed to understand how respiratory virus infection impacts individuals with RA and other autoimmune diseases. So we recognize that this is a new and emerging problem, right? That we don't have all the answers. You could ask a lot of questions, Cheryl, where we don't have the answers, right? And we already have started and touched on those. You know, we can tell you what the best data that we have indicate, but we need more data. So that's really where the HIPCRV study, the origins of that come from. And so we are recruiting research participants, individuals with RA and others, other autoimmune diseases and healthy individuals, to participate in this study, where we're really trying to better understand that intersection between respiratory virus infection and autoimmune disease.
That's super helpful. Is this something that, I don't know, I know that I had me and my son and I donated blood to like the biorepository, but does this involve donating blood, or what does it involve?
I believe there are a number of different ways you can participate. Oh, okay. Blood is certainly one of them, mm-hmm. right? That okay. we are always, and you mentioned our biorepositories, we are always recruiting for those as well, right? So anyone who wants to contribute to the research that we do on RA and other autoimmune diseases, we would encourage them to join the BRI biorepository mm-hmm. here and donate blood for our work.
It's such an easy thing to do. I'm looking at the website now. I should have done this before, but for that particular study, they said that you'll visit the clinic a couple of times over 2 years and that they'll collect nasal swabs and blood draw as well. So I'll have to sign up for that one.
We'd love to have you. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we've kind of touched on my next question, which was like how I know a lot of patients are really interested in contributing to research, or they're like, what, you know, they want to feel empowered, like they can, you know, in the same way that we participate in like legislative advocacy. What are some other ways people could get involved? People with rheumatic disease or autoimmune conditions can get involved in ongoing research, either with COVID-19 or for anything else.
Yeah, well, we already touched on the biorepositories, mm-hmm. right? Which is a really big resource that we have here at BRI. And it's one of the drivers that really enable the research that we do. So we couldn't do it without the patient involvement, right? And without the willingness to donate blood for our studies so we can better understand that. So I would really encourage people, if they're interested in that, to get in touch with us here at BRI, and we'll steer you to the right place to get signed up for that.
That's awesome. And I'm going to circle back to, Dr. Dave, do you want to say something else about that?
I would also just encourage folks, I always think like when you go to vote, you get that sticker that says I voted. like an election. I think, I wish, I always love it when people who get involved in research let people know about other people know about ways to get involved. And so that's why I so appreciate you even doing this podcast, Cheryl. I feel like, if you post on social media or you let a friend know or you let an not an interest group, but a disease focus group, a part of, say, with rheumatoid arthritis or vasculitis, you know about opportunities. That's always so helpful. And I often say this is particularly helpful for people with rare diseases who need to know about clinical trials. A lot of times, word of mouth is the fastest way you can find out about things.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've learned a lot about what influences human behavior just through being on social media. It's been really, really fascinating. I meant to ask earlier, I'm going to circle back to long COVID really quickly, and I didn't prepare you for this question, so it's okay to be like, we don't know. But some of my social media followers wanted to know is if you have a rheumatic disease, are you more likely to get long COVID? Do we know this?
We know, so far the data shows that you're more likely to get long COVID if you haven't been vaccinated, if you had a really, if you were hospitalized, and particularly if you had ICU hospitalization, say, for example, with really bad respiratory disease, with acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS, if you have diabetes, and then if you're older age, you're more likely to get long COVID. Like people under 20, one large study in the UK, for example, suggests that people under 20 really did not seem to get long COVID at the same rates.
Interesting.
For kids, like many things, kids often can be very resilient per se. That's not to mean that some kids don't get long COVID. Certainly they do, but definitely seems advanced age and more medical problems or medical history seems to put you at higher risk. I don't, and maybe Dr. Campbell has a different answer, but I don't necessarily think that people with autoimmune disease per se, unless they were hospitalized and had really bad outcomes from COVID, are more in and of themselves more likely to get long COVID. But certainly I, as well as everyone in my practice and other rheumatologists, are seeing people in our practices who are getting long COVID, whether it's from their autoimmune disease or other risk factors or just bad luck per se. I can't tell.
Yeah, I would agree with that, except to the extent that your rheumatologic disease and medications might increase your risk for some of those other risk factors, right? Put you into those higher risk groups. But otherwise, there does not seem to be a direct link between RA or other rheumatological disease and development of long COVID.
That's really helpful. And it does, because that, and it, you are more likely to get long COVID if you've had a very, very severe disease. Because that's one thing, these are my things that I comfort myself with. Well, I know I didn't have long COVID from my first two COVID infections, because I would know by now. But I was fortunate that, yeah, probably due to the vaccination and maybe, yeah, a dose of good luck that, both of them were, they were, I say that they were worse than a sinus infection, but better than the flu. I've had like, doc, I have had urgent care verified influenza where they're like, oh, we haven't had any cases of influenza yet this year. I was like, I know my body pretty well by now. Like, I feel like I have the flu. And they're like, well, they did the test. Congratulations. You're the
You've had
first case of
one, yes.
influenza A in our count in King County. That was like 2017 or something. Anyway, but yeah, for me, it was not as severe as the flu. And that's just me and but definitely noticeably worse than a sinus infection, just in terms of like the just congestion and headache and some of those fun cognitive issues, like how do I check email? So again, Dr. Campbell, you're doing great too. That's you're better than I was. But so my last question is, I know we only have 6 minutes left, and I want to be respectful of your time. But zooming out to the big picture, what advice do you have, or what words of encouragement or wisdom would you give someone who is just diagnosed with RA? Like, do you think there's good reason to be hopeful for the future? I'll start with Dr. Dave and then end with Dr. Gable.
Yeah, so absolutely. I think, seeing patients of different ages in my clinic, you realize how far we've come. I have patients who tell me about getting gold injections, for their rheumatoid arthritis. And we now have so many different medicines. There's so many different opportunities for combinations, that really, if you have insurance, which I think is the biggest factor, if you have insurance and good insurance, you have access to so many different things. I think we are reaching an era where there's talk about potentially CAR T cell therapy for rheumatoid arthritis and other autoimmune diseases that might lead to lasting remission for a lot of people, especially with the most severe types of disease manifestations. So, and I think we're also coming to that period of time in which we're going to have more personalized therapy, where we're going to eventually patients very early on, once they're diagnosed, are going to be we're going to be able to get lab testing to determine which medicines they're going to be more responsive to and less responsive to. So I really think that the way we're going to practice 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now for rheumatoid arthritis and other autoimmune diseases is going to be very different than how we're practicing now. And I think it's going to be for the betterment for patients.
That's so helpful. Thank you. What about you, Dr. Campbell?
Yeah, first off, I really agree on the precision medicine type of approach, and that I think this is really coming where we can understand people's disease a lot better right at the beginning and identify which drugs are going to work best for them, right? Everybody's disease is a little bit different. Trying to correlate what aspect of the disease will respond best to this particular medication and make those links much faster, I think is one area where I'm really hopeful. The pace of discovery in science and the pace of data generation that we have is it's truly exponential. We know so much more than we did 20, 25 years ago. It's led already to development a lot of these medications that have really benefited people with RA. Moving forward, I can only see that pace continuing to accelerate, number one. One of the things I'm most excited about in RA and in other autoimmune diseases is identifying people who are developing this disease before they have a lot of life-altering symptoms, and being able to intervene at earlier and earlier times, right? So trying to screen people, and that prevention really is the ultimate cure is comes in prevention. And if we can screen people for, particular autoantibodies and say this individual is on the road to arthritis, for example, and then intervene appropriately through a precision medicine approach, then we can really impact, the burden of disease in these individuals. So I think that's an approach that I'm really excited about taking, both in RA and in a range of other autoimmune diseases where we can do this.
Thank you. That's so exciting. It definitely echoes what Dr. Buckner and Dr. Mike Asenik, when I interviewed them a few months ago, they were mentioning that same thing. So it's really exciting for me. As somebody 20 years, I got diagnosed 21 years ago and I'm 42. So it has been amazing even just to see. There were only the three biologics when I got diagnosed. Now there's, over 10, I think. So it's really great. And I thank you all so much for your time. I know you're so busy. We're recording this on a Friday. So and your probably brains are full, but I really, really appreciate you taking your time to share the wisdom. And I'm going to put a bunch of links to you both of your where people can connect with you and then Benaroya Research Institute. But we'll just say thank you again and we'll talk to you later.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Thanks.
Thank you
Bye. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Arthritis Life Podcast. This episode is brought to you by Room to Thrive, an educational program I created from scratch to help you go from overwhelmed to confident, supported, and connected in a matter of weeks. You can go through the pre-recorded course on your own, or you can take the course along with a support group. Learn more at the link in my show notes, or you can always go to www.myarthritislife.net. And if you like this podcast, I would be so honored if you took the time to rate and review it. I also encourage you to share it with anyone you know who might benefit from it. I also wanted to remind you that you can find full transcripts, videos, and detailed show notes with hyperlinks for each episode on my website, www.myarthritislife.net. If you have any ideas for future episodes, or if you want to share your story or wisdom on the podcast, just shoot me an email at info@myarthritislife.net. I can't wait to hear from you.